Hello, welcome to Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Every week I read from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is ew.com. Oftentimes I have something called a must list. I love reading it because it talks about what we must be paying attention to this week, but I don't have one today. I do have a couple other lists, though, instead, but first let's do a couple reviews. The first one's a movie review, Megan 2.0. Allison Williams' Robo franchise trades splatter for spycraft in this entertaining sequel. With a new template installed, the killer doll transforms into the summer's least likely action hero. This is by Jordan Hoffman. Sometimes you agree to a system upgrade, put your phone down for a while, then pick it up, and it looks totally different. That's kind of what happened with Megan 2.0, the sequel to the surprise hit mid-budget horror flick, Megan. Morphing unexpectedly into daffy, tech-heavy action territory. The first installment, which could have been a dismissible evil doll movie, quickly showed it had a head on its shoulders with some rich themes about new technologies intersecting with childhood development, as well as a sharp ear for dialogue. It became a bit of a sensation, aided by some social media-ready quips and dance moves. A hit like this deserves a sequel, but thankfully writer-director Gerard Johnstone didn't take the easy route. Allison Williams' brilliant roboticist, Gemma Forrester, does not follow the Jurassic Park formula, building another Model 3 generative android, Megan, but this time with better safety protocols. It's quite the opposite. At the beginning of the story, she is the face of Modern Moderation, the name of her bestseller. She is a futurist arguing for regulation, especially where artificial intelligence meets kids. Because, if you remember, her invention killed a lot of people last time. She will, of course, be forced by circumstances to summon up her old golem before we hit the 30-minute mark. That's because the Department of Defense got in its head that it should build an AI Jason Bourne to go places like the Turkish-Iranian border to engage in secret missions. Their creation, Amelia, Autonomous Military Engagement Logistics and Infiltration Android, played by Ivana Sakhno, quickly ignores her commands and soon takes off on a quest that the authorities don't understand but quickly recognize to be dangerous. With that, Gemma and her team, that's Jen Van Epps's Tess and Brian Jordan Alvarez's Cole, resurrect Megan, who actually managed to encrypt herself into Gemma's smart home, but still needs a new body. Gemma's niece Katie, played by Violet McGraw, is still easily susceptible to Megan's charms, but with time, the AI appears to have advanced to a new level of maturity, e.g., she doesn't want to kill people. Is she to be trusted? We'll find out after our first adventure in which the team must outmaneuver Amelia in getting important data from an Elon Musk-like tool played with maximum sleaze by Jemaine Clement. Amelia ranks alongside Kristanna Loken in Terminator 3, Natasha Henstridge in Species, and Mathilda May in Life Force, a personal fave, as a dangerous inhuman beauty that quickly turns men to jelly. Eventually, she and the scrappy bon mot-spewing Megan will get their showdown, and it will not disappoint. While that eventual climax is to be expected, the wheres and whys of it are quite unpredictable. Megan 2.0 luxuriates in the tropes of heist and spy movies, taking us to secret hideouts that almost reach Austin Powers' level of parody. But the reason this movie works as well as it does is that everyone plays it totally straight. The film succeeds as camp because, for the characters, it is deadly serious. God knows how many takes were ruined by laughter, barking out all this end-of-the-world dialogue opposite that weird-looking doll. Megan 2.0's script has all the necessary action-adventure beats plus a second coat of comedic paint. Imagine watching Mission Impossible: The Final Reckoning, with the characters occasionally taking a drag off a cigarette and vamping. Can you believe this? But it never pushes things too far. One could, I suppose, enjoy this movie purely as an action thriller if you aren't attuned to its "they all know this is a scream" wavelength. In other words, Lil Violet McGraw accusing Allison Williams of dressing like a Portuguese prostitute is something some people would find gloriously funny and simply won't register with others. The actual plot of this movie is confusing and idiotic. I really had no idea what the main baddie was trying to accomplish, but luckily, this is not an obstacle to having fun. As far as the action is concerned, Gerard Johnstone clearly worships at the altar of Sam Raimi, and while nothing quite reaches this level of visual punch, there's a lot more creativity here than in typical mid-budget Hollywood fare. There's also a clever homage to Fritz Lang's Metropolis for the hardcore cinephiles. A spin-off to Megan is already en route, but here's hoping the main series continues forever. I'd like to see Allison Williams age up with futuristic tech, bickering with her Weisenheimer creation as they continue to battle bad guys until the AI apocalypse finally comes and destroys us all. That was the review of Megan 2.0, Allison Williams' robo-franchise trades splatter for spycraft in this entertaining sequel. It was by Jordan Hoffman, who's giving the movie a grade of B. In the TV section, we have a review of The Bear. Jeremy Allen White's culinary hit recaptures its fire in season 4. FX's hit comedy drama bounces back in a raw and riveting new season. This is by Kristen Baldwin. In season 4 of The Bear, Chef Carmen Carmi Burzato, played by Jeremy Allen White, states the obvious. "I'm not great with consistency," he tells Chef Sidney, played by Ayo Edebiri, his exceptionally talented and long-suffering partner at the titular restaurant. This is not news to Sid, nor to fans of The Bear itself. After amassing acclaim with 2 excellent seasons, the Chicago-set culinary dramedy, don't at-sign me, from creator Christopher Storer stumbled in 2024 with a slow and self-indulgent third outing. Lots of great shows make mistakes. Fewer can course-correct their way out of disappointment. Thankfully, The Bear is one of them. Though not quite at the level of the sublime second season, the new episodes put Carmen and company back on track by allowing them to confront, at long last, the effing elephant in the effing restaurant. As the trailer reveals, the Chicago Tribune review was not a rave, and when we rejoin our chefs at The Bear, everyone is feeling a little stuck. Carmen, having fallen asleep on the couch, literally wakes up to Groundhog Day playing on his living room TV, while Sidney can't decide what to do about the job offer from Adam Shapiro. Richie, played by Iban Mas Bacharach, is struggling to find the perfect inspirational words for his pre-service speeches to the staff, but nothing sounds right. That stasis is broken, though, when Uncle Jimmy, played by Oliver Platt, and Computer, played by Brian Koppelman, arrive one morning and put a literal countdown clock in the kitchen. If The bear can't turn things around and start making money by the time the clock hits zero. The restaurant needs to cease operations, Jimmy explains. With this season's looming deadline in place, Richie recruits the house staff from Ever, Jessica, played by Sarah Ramos, Garrett, played by Andrew Lopez, and Renee, played by Renee Gube, to serve as a kind of culinary Avengers and help bring order to the operation's chaos. But as you may have guessed by now, Carmi and his kitchen family will not be able to make their restaurant a success until they figure out who they are outside its four walls. Initially, the return of the Ever staff made me nervous. One of last season's biggest weaknesses was an over-reliance on callbacks to the Bear's greatest hits. This year, though, the show strikes a much better balance between fan service, fun with the facts, and forward story momentum. The new episodes have just enough of what we want from the show. Those exciting, fast-paced dinner service scenes, a carefully curated Gen X soundtrack, R.E.M., Talk Talk, The Pretenders, Brian Ferry, and moments of classic Bear cacophony, with Richie and Carmen barking at each other while Carmi's sister, Sugar, played by Amy Elliott, hisses at them to lower their effing voices already. Still, season four is at its best when the yelling stops and the cousins are forced to listen and be heard. Clocks are everywhere. The large black box counting down the seconds until the bear runs out of money. A flashing 12 o'clock on a home range, the digital timer Tina, played by Lisa Colon Zayas, uses as she tries to finish a pasta dish in under 3 minutes. This type of imagery has always been a big motif in The Bear, every second counts after all, and now it extends beyond the kitchen as the characters start to understand that it's not just the restaurant that's running out of time. It's all of us, every day. The realization pushes several of them, Carmen included, to say the really scary stuff out loud. To Sid, to Richie, and yes, even to his estranged mother Donna, played by Jamie Lee Curtis. The cameo-packed, supersized episode is becoming a Bear tradition, and this season's takes place at a festive gathering where lots of Berzados are in attendance. Though the celebrity sightings are fun, the most powerful moment in the 69-minute installment comes when two people, Carmen and a relative who shall remain nameless for spoiler reasons, have a quiet conversation in an empty room. They talk about guilt, about Carmen's late brother Mikey, played by John Bernthal, and about the importance of not keeping everything so locked up. The episode, which also features a payoff to a long-running mystery and an impromptu family therapy session courtesy of Richie's daughter, Ava, played by Annabelle Toomey, is a beautiful complement to the pandemonium of the Emmy-winning Fishes from season two. Alluding to that Christmas catastrophe, Carmi's relative urges the young chef to stop being so hard on himself for fleeing his family's dysfunction. Sometimes to break patterns, you gotta break patterns, man. A simple conversation is also at the centerpiece of the season's most unexpected and delightful episode, written by Adeburi and Lionel Boyce, who plays the Bear's introspective pastry chef, Marcus. In it, Sid finds herself babysitting a friend's tween daughter, TJ, Arian King, a star in the making, and the two spend the afternoon talking about a sleepover TJ isn't sure she should attend. By the end of their time together, Sid's able to sort through key questions she has about her own career. Adeburi is a phenomenally talented comedic actress. She can turn a reaction shot into a punchline with one exasperated nod. None of us may be able to agree on whether The Bear is a comedy or a drama. I fall in the latter camp, but few would dispute that it's currently the best-acted show on TV. White continues to find new ways to embody Carmi's inner turmoil and miserable mien, and Moss Bacharach makes Richie's hurt so palpable that when he lashes out, we feel it like a punch to the gut. Storer ensures that everyone in the stellar and expansive ensemble gets some time to shine, highlighting the earnest ambition of line cook Ibrahim, played by Edwin Lee Gibson, the gentle way Sugar gets through to Carmen in his darker moments, Tina's maternal wisdom, and the chattering comic relief of the Fack brothers, played by Maddie Matheson and Ricky Steffieri. Though this season is a big improvement over the meandering, montage-filled season that preceded it, The Bear still grapples with pacing problems. The supersized episode mentioned above definitely would have benefited from more time in the editing bay, and Storer still allows himself to take the show on tangents. Sometimes these narrative adventures work. See Kate Berlant as a woman in Carmi's Al-Anon group absolutely crushing an episode-opening monologue. More often, they slow things down. See Carmi in that same episode taking a field trip to a museum for some reason. People go to restaurants to be taken care of, muses Carmen in the season 4 premiere. There's a tragic kind of symmetry in the way Carmen Burzatto, a guy who grew up in a household devoid of nurturing, later devotes his life to caring for strangers. The kid may not be great with consistency, but he's making some real progress. All 10 episodes of The Bear Season 4 are streaming on Hulu. That was The Bear Review. Jeremy Allen White's culinary hit recaptures its fire in Season 4. It was by Kristen Baldwin, who's giving the season a grade of B+. Also from the TV section, the best shows of 2025 so far. So see, we do have a list for today. The Year's Finest TV features Stressed Out Doctors, Bifurcated Office Drones, and a very cranky British detective. This is also by Kristen Baldwin. Congrats on making it halfway through this year. While many, many things have happened or are happening this year are not great, TV remains a bright spot. Returning shows including Severance and Abbott Elementary shined with stellar seasons, while a passel of new series like The Pitt got our hearts racing. So stop doom scrolling and start binge watching. Your to-do list begins below. The first show on the list is Severance from Apple TV+. All Keir Egan wanted to do was eliminate pain from the human experience. But if Severance has taught us anything, it's that science can no more separate us from our hurt than it can stop the moon from controlling the tides. In its long-awaited second season, the darkly funny, exquisitely weird drama served up some key answers about Lumen Industries while pushing its characters to embrace their whole selves, both in and out of the office. Much like the employees in Lumen's macro data refinement department, Severance contains multitudes: office comedy, sci-fi thriller, artsy allegory about worker exploitation, star-crossed romance, family drama. Marshmallows are for team players, but Severance is for everyone who's ever felt the ache of a broken heart. Forever is on Netflix. Adapted by Mara Brock Akil from Judy Blume's groundbreaking 1975 young adult novel, Forever reminds us that while times change, the exquisite and excruciating drama of first love remains the same. Keisha, played by Lovey Simone, and Justin, played by Michael Cooper Jr., two high-achieving black teens in 2018 Los Angeles, fall hard after meeting at a New Year's Eve party. and the subsequent relationship upends their lives in ways that are blissful, complicated, and ultimately profound. Akeel translates Bloom's classic romance for the modern era, then waiting by the phone, now being left on read. She builds on it with a rich, moving story about Black excellence and the American dream. Matlock is on CBS. Procedurals, especially CBS procedurals, get a bad rap from snobby TV critics like me. Known for their uninspired concepts, FBI, CIA, rote character development and predictable plotting, these types of dramas can be great to fold laundry to, but that's about it. When I first read about Matlock, a reboot of the classic legal drama starring Kathy Bates in the Andy Griffith role, I assumed it'd be just another example of a network putting IP ahead of ideas. But as Bates, Madeline, Maddie, Matlock might say, you know what happens when you assume, darling? Developed by Jenny Snyder Ehrman, who we know from Jane the Virgin, Matlock is the rare procedural, and even rarer reboot, that puts characters first. Bates is Emmy-worthy as Madeline, a folksy senior citizen lawyer slash undercover grieving mom out to destroy a corrupt firm, and the show mixes clever case-of-the-week intrigue with heartfelt stories of grief, betrayal, and regret. If you had told me a year ago that I'd be this invested in the future of Maddie's friendship with her boss Olympia, played by the superb Sky P. Marshall, I'd have laughed. But hey, it feels great to be wrong. The Gilded Age is on HBO Max. The third season just started on June 22nd, so I'll keep my praise spoiler-free. Julian Fellowes' sumptuous period piece levels up yet again with 8 episodes of captivating, emotional, and escapist drama about New York's high society in the 1880s. Not only does the new season give more attention to the Scott family, Peggy, played by Denis Benton, Dorothy, played by Audra McDonald, and Arthur, played by John Douglas Thompson, it also delivers standout storylines for put-upon heiress Gladys Russell, played by Tessa Farminga, and footman and aspiring inventor Jack Trotter, played by Ben Ehlers, executing an exaggerated New York accent that's somehow more adorable than grating. And Blake Rutzen deserves a special shout-out for his delightfully droll performance as the closeted Oscar Van Rijn, whose arc this season travels through tragedy and ends up on the cusp of a tantalizing triumph. Abbott Elementary on ABC. 4 years in, Quinta Brunson's Emmy-winning comedy continues to set the standard. Many sitcoms stumble when it comes time to get their will-they-won't-they leads together, but Abbott soared, allowing Janine, played by Brunson, and Gregory, played by Tyler James Williams, to deepen their relationship without sacrificing its goofy sweetness. Season 4 saw Abbott taking big swings, firing Janelle James's indispensable principal Ava, executing a highly weird yet somehow perfect crossover with It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, and crushing it every time. Boasting the best comedy ensemble on TV, Abbott uses humor and hope to explore the realities of race and class inequity in public education, and yet it never feels like school. Maybe that's because we love the characters this much. Their battles become ours. Department Q on Netflix. As a certified scaredy cat, I wasn't sure I could handle Department Q, but this harrowing crime drama from Scott Frank, who we know from The Queen's Gambit, had me hooked from its premiere episode twist, so bravery is a must. Adapted from Jussi Adler-Olsen's book series, Department Q follows DCI Mork, played by Matthew Good, an aggressively unpleasant British detective who returns to his Edinburgh department after getting shot on the job. Desperate to avoid the trauma of his near-death experience, Mork takes on a new assignment heading up a new cold cases department, along with a team of fellow precinct misfits. Akram Salim, played by Alexej Mandelov, a Syrian refugee and brilliant investigator, Rose, played by Lee Byrne, an anxious constable grappling with OCD and PTSD, and Detective Sergeant Hardy, played by Jamie Seaves, paralyzed in the same shooting that injured Mork. Blending gallows humor with shoe-leather police work, riveting performances, and a twisted central mystery, Department Q manages to find hope and healing in the midst of human-on-human horror. Beyond the Gates on CBS. Soap operas do the impossible. Working with a fraction of the budget primetime series get, soaps crank out 260 episodes of nonstop story a year. For those of us who grew up loving these shows, watching the network slowly abandon the genre over the past decade has been painful. What a joy, then, to witness the birth of Beyond the Gates, the first new daytime drama since 1999. Created by soap legend Michel Valjean, Gates centers on the saga of the well-to-do Dupree family, pillars of society in an elite and drama-filled black enclave near Washington, D.C. It's impossible to summarize everything that's happened in the 80 episodes since Gates premiered in February, but the soapiest highlights include a love child revealed in spectacular fashion, and a marriage ruined. A steamy and top-secret May December romance between a former supermodel and a playboy photographer. A promising young politician haunted by a violent incident from his past. To quote the late, great Gary Marshall in Soap Dish, this is soap opera. The Pit on HBO Max. No one wants to spend a day in an ER, but damn if The Pit didn't make those 15 hours fly by. The real-time medical drama offers a relentlessly frank exploration of America's broken healthcare system and the dedicated doctors, nurses, and hospital staff who refuse to break under its weight. Anchored by a phenomenal performance by Noah Wyle as Dr. Robbie Rabinovich, The Pit also features an ensemble packed with standouts, including but not limited to Taylor Dearden, beautifully earnest as second-year resident Mel King, Catherine Lanassa, a mesmerizing force as the unflappable charge nurse Dana Evans, and Michael Hyatt, who brings heart to the role of Robbie's budget-conscious boss, Gloria Underwood. Like all great hospital dramas, The Pit spikes our heart rate with urgent medical crises, but it also leaves us with the hope that when it comes time for our own life and death battle, we won't be fighting alone. Those are the best TV shows of 2025 so far, according to Kristen Baldwin. This is a good time for me to take a quick break here to say that you are listening to Entertainment Weekly. I'm reading from their website, which is EW.com. Those were the best shows. Now we're going to hear about one that was canceled. Shipwrecked. Dr. Odyssey canceled after one season on ABC. Joshua Jackson, Philippa Sue, and Sean Teal's ship has sunk. This is by Sydney Buxbaum. Dr. Odyssey has hit rough waters. Entertainment Weekly has confirmed that ABC's cruise ship medical drama is ending after one season. Created by Ryan Murphy, Dr. Odyssey starred Joshua Jackson, Philippa Sue, and Sean Teal as a groundbreaking, for network TV, potential throuple as the medical staff on a cruise ship captained by Don Johnson. The news of the show's cancellation comes in the wake of a lawsuit filed by three members of the props crew against the parent company Disney and producer 20th Television, alleging sexual harassment, retaliation, wrongful termination, and negligent hiring, retention, and supervising practices. Earlier this month, Caroline Mack, Alicia Haverland, and Ava Steinbrenner alleged in the suit that Tyler Patton, hired by the companies to serve as Dr. Odyssey's assistant prop master under his wife, prop master Tammy Patton, subjected them to an unchecked campaign of sexual harassment for months. Disney, 20th Television, and Tammy and Tyler Patton did not respond to Entertainment Weekly's requests for comment at the time. According to the suit, Tyler and several other male props employees allegedly created an unlawful den of sexual harassment and retaliation, which the suit claims Tammy Patton not only ignored but subjected them to retaliation for complaining about. The plaintiffs allege that Disney and 20th TV ignored their complaints and ultimately laid off the entire props department rather than investigate and take appropriate action. Mack, Haverland, and Steinbrenner are requesting a jury trial. Dr. Odyssey's May 15th season one ender delivered closure for every character, making it a surprisingly satisfying series finale. Max, played by Jackson, and Avery, played by Sue, finally declared their love for each other and committed to being together long distance while following their individual dreams. Avery going to medical school and Max staying on the cruise ship. And Tristan, played by Teal, took not being chosen by Avery surprisingly well. The lack of drama and clear conclusion for the love triangle was the most shocking part of the episode. Plus, everyone survived the tsunami wave and earthquake aftershocks. The captain was able to keep his job despite not following orders during the crisis. And they all celebrated by dancing to Despacito on the beach. Not a bad way to go out for a cancellation after one season. That was Shipwrecked, Dr. Odyssey canceled after one season on ABC. Here's my other list of this episode, how to watch every live-action Jurassic Park movie in order. Here's your guide to revisiting the sci-fi franchise ahead of Jurassic World Rebirth. This is by Will Harris. As a novelist, film director, and screenwriter, Michael Crichton has had his fingerprints all over cinema for decades, from Westworld in 1973 and its recent HBO incarnation to The Andromeda Strain, The Great Train Robbery, Coma, Rising Sun, Looker, Twister, and Congo, among others. But needless to say, the Crichton property with the biggest pop culture impact is the Jurassic Park franchise. The franchise began in 1993 with Steven Spielberg's blockbuster adaptation of Jurassic Park. The appeal is built on two ideas. One, the amazing feat of using prehistoric DNA to clone new dinosaurs, and two, the terrifying prospect of those dinosaurs behaving like, well, dinosaurs, namely the carnivorous ones. It's the kind of self-fulfilling scientific prophecy that great disaster movies are made of, or in this case, a trilogy of disaster movies, which later spawned a follow-up trilogy. Now there's a seventh film on the horizon, Jurassic World Rebirth, set for release on July 2nd. With its impending arrival, there's no better time to revisit the whole series. As such, here's how to watch the Jurassic Park movies in order. The first, Jurassic Park, 1993. Idealistic tycoon John Hammond, played by Richard Attenborough, has a vision. Use modern technology to bring back prehistoric creatures and create a theme park of sorts, a Jurassic Park, if you will, that gives visitors the opportunity to see living, breathing dinosaurs in something akin to a natural habitat. Before opening the park to visitors, however, Hammond invites two paleontologists, Alan Grant, played by Sam Neill, and Ellie Sattler, played by Laura Dern, and chaos theory expert Ian Malcolm, played by Jeff Goldblum, to the island of Isla Nublar to let them in on his big scientific secret. Alan and Ellie are awestruck by the fruits of Hammond's breakthrough, but they maintain concerns about the ethics of it all and the possible dangers. Ian, meanwhile, waxes philosophical about the situation, dissecting the unpredictable nature of genetic engineering and, yes, life itself. Hammond's best-laid plans be damned. All three find their worst fears realized, and right at the wrong time, with Hammond's grandchildren along for a sneak peek tour. Rogue employee Dennis Nedry, played by Wayne Knight, cuts the power to the park. He's merely trying to steal the dinosaur embryos and sell them to Hammond's top rival, but in the process he leaves the dinosaurs free to escape from their pens and go on a rampage. Suddenly, questions about the park's opening are shunted aside in favor of whether or not anyone on the island can survive. We can watch Jurassic Park on Hulu. Next, it's The Lost World, Jurassic Park, from 1997. Hammond's efforts to get Jurassic Park off the ground have fallen apart, leaving his company, InGen, in dire financial straits. To rescue InGen from bankruptcy, Hammond's nephew, Peter Ludlow, played by Arliss Howard, who wrested control of the company away from his uncle after the park debacle, wants to exploit the dinosaurs. His focus is the creatures located on Isla Sorna, the sister island to Isla Nublar, where InGen's cloning facilities were located. Hammond, not wanting the dinosaurs disturbed, sends behavioral paleontologist Sarah Harding, played by Julianne Moore, to Isla Sorna, where the dinosaurs have been living without human interference. When Hammond loses contact, however, he calls in Ian Malcolm, who, by sheer coincidence, is Sarah's boyfriend. When Ian arrives, accompanied by equipment specialist Eddie Carr, played by Richard Schiff, and documentarian Nick Van Owen, played by Vince Vaughn, he discovers a stowaway, his daughter Kelly. It's not long before they realize Ludlow has also arrived and brought along a team of mercenaries and big game hunters. Their intent, capture dinosaurs and bring them back to the mainland, with visions of some sort of sold-out dinosaur show dancing before their eyes, doubtlessly alongside lots of dollar signs. What could possibly go wrong? Oh, only everything, starting with a T-Rex running rampant in the streets of San Diego. We can watch Lost World Jurassic Park, also on Hulu. Jurassic Park 3 is from 2001. Since the mess that went down at Jurassic Park years earlier, Alan Grant has been struggling with his Velociraptor research. He's approached by Paul and Amanda Kirby, played by William H. Macy and Taya Leone, who tell him they've obtained permission to enter the airspace around Isla Sorna and offer to fund his research if he'll provide them with an aerial tour. He needs the money too much to say no. While their plane is circling the island, however, Alan realizes he's been had, at which point he's knocked unconscious. When he awakens, the plane has already landed, and before long, the group is under attack by a dinosaur, a Spinosaurus to be specific, that destroys the plane and kills the pilot. Now, trapped on the island, the Kirbys reveal the truth. They're actually a divorced couple, and not a rich one, to Alan's profound annoyance, whose son was illegally parasailing around the island with Amanda's boyfriend. Both have been missing for 8 weeks. The Kirbys believed Alan could help, not realizing he'd never actually been to Isla Sorna. Of course, none of that matters at this point, as they share a new goal beyond finding the missing duo: get off the island alive. We can watch Jurassic Park 3 on Hulu. Jurassic World from 2015. It's been years since the Jurassic Park incidents, and all has apparently been forgiven by the general public. Isla Nublar is now home to Jurassic World, which is everything the late John Hammond dreamed of. Owned by Masrani Global, which bought out InGen, the park has become a phenomenon, aided in no small part by operations manager Claire Deering, played by Bryce Dallas Howard. She invites her nephews, Zach and Gray, to visit, but given her busy schedule, they wind up making their own way through the park. Then there's Owen Grady, played by Chris Pratt, who spends his time training velociraptors and researching their intelligence. He actually cares about the animals and is vehemently at odds with his boss, Vic Hoskins, played by Vincent D'Onofrio, who wants to weaponize them. Hovering around it all is the pending debut of the park's latest attraction, the Indominus Rex, a dinosaur genetically engineered from other dinos' DNA by Dr. Henry Wu, played by B.D. Wong, and which can both camouflage itself and mask its heat signature. It should come as no surprise that the Indominus Rex manages to escape, wreaking havoc on the park and its systems while Claire's nephews are in the midst of their tour. Claire and Owen team up to find them, while the other guests suddenly find themselves on the receiving end of a full-fledged dinosaur attack. We can watch Jurassic World on Amazon Prime Video. Jurassic World: Fallen Kingdom is from 2018. 3.5 years after the Jurassic World incident, a volcanic eruption is imminent on Isla Nublar, and a Senate committee is debating whether or not the dinosaurs should be saved. Ian Malcolm testifies that they should be left to suffer the natural fate that would befall any creature living on the island, but Claire isn't having it. Having founded the Dinosaur Protection Group, she takes Hammond's former partner, Benjamin Lockwood, played by James Cromwell, up on his offer to relocate the dinosaurs to a new island sanctuary. There's particular interest in finding Blue, Owen's beloved velociraptor, so naturally Claire drafts him to come along. On the island, however, it turns out Lockwood's aide, Eli Mills, played by Raph Spall, has a very different plan, one that doesn't require the services of Claire or Owen once the dinosaurs are in hand. His team leaves our heroes to die, but they manage to sneak onto the ship for the trip home. Back on the mainland, they discover Mills' plan: auction the dinosaurs off to the highest bidders. Thanks to Dr. Wu, there's a new genetically created dino in the mix, the Indoraptor, an Indominus Rex and Velociraptor hybrid. Claire and Owen intend to thwart this burgeoning black market, but there's another key figure in the mix: Lockwood's granddaughter, Maisie, who has a secret origin even she doesn't know about. And our sixth movie is Jurassic World Dominion from 2022. 4 years after the aborted dinosaur auction, the world is a very different place. Dinosaurs are no longer isolated to the islands, but instead roam free in something of a tenuous coexistence with mankind. Biosyngenetics is putting together a dinosaur preserve in Italy, with an eye toward the possible pharmaceutical applications, or at least that's the story they tell. Meanwhile, Claire and Owen are raising Maisie, keeping her as under the radar as possible, lest she be found and experimented on by scientists enthralled by her unique origin. To bring the Jurassic franchise full circle, Ellie Sattler is investigating the sudden arrival of giant locust swarms and asks Alan Grant for help in determining where they've come from. Inevitably, Maisie is kidnapped, In the process of searching for her, Claire and Owen find their way to Malta on a tip from Franklin Webb, Claire's fellow dinosaur activist who's now working for the CIA's Dangerous Species Division. In Malta, they discover Maisie's whereabouts. Biosyn HQ, where the firm's owner, Dr. Lewis Dodson, played by Campbell Scott, is providing gainful employment to both Dr. Henry Wu and Ian Malcolm. Ellie and Alan, naturally, are there too. Of Jurassic World Dominion, one can legitimately say, it's all been leading up to this. Mileage may vary on the end result, but seeing the old and new Jurassic casts team up is pretty hard to resist. We can watch Jurassic World Dominion on Peacock. So there they are, the six Jurassic Park movies in order. That's how to watch every live-action Jurassic Park movie, and it was by Will Harris. Next, we have What Happened to Jane Mansfield? Inside the life and career of the iconic actress and sex symbol. Hargitay Mansfield's daughter directed the new HBO doc about the 50s bombshell. This is by Randall Colburn. Here are some key points. Jane Mansfield was one of the most famous and infamous actresses and tabloid fixtures of the 50s and 60s. The bombshell is the subject of a new HBO documentary, My Mom Jane, from her daughter Mariska Hargitay, and the documentary is now streaming on HBO Max. Jane Mansfield, one of the defining sex symbols of the 1950s and 60s, is the subject of a new HBO documentary, My Mom Jane. As its title implies, the documentary is directed by Mansfield's daughter, Mariska Hargitay, best known as Olivia Benson on Law and Order Special Victims Unit. An intensely personal film, it finds Hargitay, who was just 3 years old when Mansfield died, publicly working to reconcile what she knows and remembers about her mother with Mansfield's lingering reputation as a quote-unquote dumb blonde, famous primarily because of her large bust. The project has allowed Hargitay to develop a new appreciation for her mother's intelligence and savvy when it came to traversing celebrity and cultivating a public image. Mansfield, after all, perseveres in culture in part due to the ways she operated as an influencer decades before that was a thing. I'm so in awe of what she did, what she accomplished, and what she navigated, Hargitay told Entertainment Weekly ahead of the film's release. Her determination, her appetite, her ambition, what she wanted to achieve while at the same time wanting this full life, it's really extraordinary. And I do believe in so many ways she was ahead of her time. Here's an overview of Mansfield from the star's early appearances in Playboy to her defining era in Hollywood and tumultuous final years. Who is Jane Mansfield? Mansfield was born Vera Jane Palmer on April 19, 1933, in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, the only child of Herbert William Palmer, an attorney, and Vera Jeffrey Palmer, and grew up dreaming of Hollywood stardom. She married Paul Mansfield at the age of 17, giving birth to a daughter, Jane Marie Mansfield, that same year. While raising the child, she studied acting at a handful of different schools, including the University of Texas at Austin and UCLA, and won a number of beauty contests. Her career got a boost from famed director Sidney Lumet, whose father, Baruch Lumet, was Mansfield's acting teacher. He secured her a screen test at Paramount in 1954, and the Mansfield family moved to Los Angeles that year. But it was her appearance as Playboy's February 1955 Playmate of the Month that served as her big break, helping her land small roles in films that eventually led to a breakout role opposite Walter Matthau and Orson Bean in a 1955 Broadway production of Will Success Spoil Rock Hunter. She went on to reprise the role for the 1957 film adaptation and also turned heads in films like The Girl Can't Help It in 1956 and The Wayward Bus in 1957, the latter of which won her a Golden Globe for New Star of the Year. Due to her voluptuous figure and her rising status as a publicity magnet, 20th Century Fox signed Mansfield to a contract with the hopes of turning her into the next Marilyn Monroe. Though she enjoyed success with 1958's The Sheriff of Fractured Jaw, the studio soon cooled on the actress and she spent much of the rest of her career acting in supporting roles, appearing on variety shows and touring nightclubs. She remained a tabloid fixture, however, especially after being the first mainstream American actress to appear nude in a starring role with Promises, Promises in 1963. What happened to Jane Mansfield? Throughout the 60s, Mansfield's dreams of being a dramatic actress evaporated as studios lost interest in her talents. As such, she chased fame via publicity stunts, such as a cheeky campaign for president in 1964, and other ventures, including a novelty album in which she read Shakespeare sonnets over the music of Russian composer Pyotr Ilyich Tchaikovsky. Her personal life remained a hyper-focus of the media as she cycled through a number of marriages, affairs, rumored and not, and pregnancies. Mansfield and Paul split amid her career rise, with her filing for divorce in 1956 and claiming Paul refused to support her and was jealous of her chihuahua. Just days after their divorce finalized in 1958, Mansfield married Mickey Hargitay, an actor and former Mr. Universe. The couple had two children, Mickey Jr. and Zoltan, and starred opposite each other in films such as The Loves of Hercules in 1960 and L'Amor Primitivo in 1964. Following media chatter about her affairs with Italian producer Enrico Bomba and comedian Nelson Sardelli, Mansfield and Mickey divorced in 1964, though their relationship had been on the rocks for a while. After Mansfield discovered she was pregnant, she and Mickey publicly denied their split, lest Mansfield see her career imperiled as an unwed mother. In 1964, Mansfield gave birth to Mariska, who revealed in May 2025 that Sardelli was her biological father, not Mickey, as was the narrative all these years. That same year, she married film and stage director Matt Simber, with whom she had another son, Tony. They separated less than a year later and filed for divorce in 1966. She then began living with Sam Brody, her attorney, in a custody battle with Simber. By several accounts, it was a tumultuous union allegedly exacerbated by alcohol and drugs. How did Jane Mansfield die? Mansfield died at the age of 37 in a car accident on June 28, 1967. During a trip to Biloxi, Mississippi, in which she performed at nightclubs and visited an Air Force base, Mansfield and Brody accepted a ride from a chauffeur who crashed his car into a truck amid a cloud of mosquito insecticide. The driver, Mansfield, Brody, and two of Mansfield's four dogs died instantly. Mickey Jr., Zoltan, and Mariska were in the back seat, but only suffered minor injuries. In the aftermath, rumors circulated that Mansfield was decapitated in the crash, though this was disputed by Undertaker Jim Roberts, who saw her body and told the New York Times in 1997 that her head was attached as much as mine is. Where can I watch my mom, Jane? My Mom Jane is currently streaming on HBO Max. That was What Happened to Jane Mansfield, inside the life and career of the iconic actress and sex symbol, and it was by Randall Colburn. And to wrap up this episode, I have Owen Wilson can't remember his own movie taglines during Hot Ones quiz. This was on the poster? This is by Kristen Baldwin. Now we know what it takes to make famously laid-back actor Owen Wilson lose his cool about 135,600 Scovilles. During a June 26 appearance on Hot Ones, Wilson, who currently stars in the Apple TV Plus golf comedy Stick, agreed to play a game of Name That Tagline with host Sean Evans while sampling a wing doused with Da Bomb Beyond Insanity hot sauce. The premise is simple. Evans reads a tagline from one of Wilson's films, and the actor has to guess which movie it's from. We actually played this with Vince Vaughn, added Evans. He was like 7 for 8. Wilson, however, did not fare as well. The actor struggled from the outset, failing to identify Hall Pass, 1 week, no rules, from the line on its poster. I don't know, wedding crashers, Wilson guessed after downing some milk. It went south from there. I'm having a hard time focusing my brain, he admitted. After having no luck recognizing the tagline for the Royal Tenenbaums, the spice-addled actor knew he was flailing. Really? This was on the poster? We can watch his struggle in the show that's linked in this article. It's beginning at minute 15 and 6 seconds. Earlier in the interview, before he was in too much pain, Wilson looked back on the arduous process of readying for his first film, Bottle Rocket, which he starred in and co-wrote with director Wes Anderson, for release. The first movie that we ever made, Bottle Rocket, it's always nice when somebody comes up and likes that one, because that one was really kind of a tortured post-production process of not test screening well, and it seemed like it might not even come out, he said. Wilson said his most challenging film shoot, however, came 2 years later in a blockbuster directed by Michael Bay. I just remember Armageddon. There was a lot of stuff of us being in the spacesuits and being on the asteroid, he recalled, and these spacesuits that we had, they were not that comfortable. That was just a long, long shoot doing that movie. And I died in it, too. So I didn't even have to do the last third of it. That was Owen Wilson can't remember his own movie taglines during Hot Ones quiz, and it was by Kristen Baldwin. And I have to say, those Hot Ones episodes are always fun to watch. So that's the end of the time I have for Entertainment Weekly this week. Thank you all for listening. Those were some good reviews and interesting articles. And I will say, I agree with the author about the bear. That is no comedy. That's a drama. But okay, enough of controversy. Thank you all for listening this week. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm looking forward to next week when we all get to hear what I found. Until then, goodbye.